Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 349, titled The Destabilization of the FBI. This is being recorded on February 25th of the year 2002, and for those of you who might be convinced that I had flipped before, you're really going to think that I've basically lost my marbles when you hear this broadcast. Suffice it to say that in other programs, I've spoken about the destabilization of the United States. I've spoken about my belief that the United States is currently undergoing a destabilization both from without and from within, not unlike the destabilization of France that occurred prior to the Second World War. And while France was engaged in a foreign war against a hostile power, that being World War II, it was at the same time subverted from within. This is along the keeping of the scenario that I presented in, for the record, 344, 5, and 6, that basically this constituted a Pearl Harbor meets the Reichstag fire scenario. If Adolf Hitler had been in the White House when Pearl Harbor was attacked, this is what you would be seeing. More about that in a minute. Before I get directly into the subject material, namely the destabilization of the FBI, and by the way, many of the articles and items that I'm talking about in this program will be articles or items that I have dealt with in past broadcasts. I ask your indulgence. They have not been grouped together and conceptualized as they are in this program. But again, this is a very complex state of affairs, and I would encourage people not to oversimplify the analysis of the September 11th events. Now, before I get into the destabilization of the FBI, I want to read an article that was researched for us by a member of the listening audience. This is from the Morris County, New Jersey Daily Record of Thursday, February 7th of the year 2002. This article is an AP story, Dateline New York. Its headline, New Jersey Name Found on Taliban Document. It reads in part as follows. A list of apparent Taliban recruits found in an Afghanistan house includes the name of a New Jersey high school valedictorian who spoke with contempt about America as a teenager, the New York Times reported Wednesday. A Times reporter found the undated document in December in a house in Kabul that neighbors said had been used by pro-Taliban Pakistani militants. It lists the name, New Jersey address, and telephone number of Hiram Torres. Quote, he is 20 years old, unmarried, knows driving, unquote, the document said. Torres, a 1993 high school graduate, would be 27 today, indicating the document is 7 years old. Now we're going to listen to Torres' background. We've heard a lot about John Walker Lind, the much-ballyhooed American Taliban from Marin County. We've been told about how his the permissive background of Marin County led to his becoming a Taliban, sort of the implication being that his parents were aging hippies and didn't spank him enough. Listen to the background of Hiram Torres, not only a high school valedictorian, but an individual who spent a month at Yale University. His background is a long way from the spin that we're being given about John Walker Lind, and we've not been hearing much about Hiram Torres. His background and his apparent factors of genesis, so to speak. Torres' unsmiling face stares from pages of Perth Amboy High School's 1992 and 1993 yearbooks and pictures of the German Club, German Honor Society, and cross-country track team, skipping down. Penny Borkowski, who was in most of Torres' high school classes and knew him from the German Club, said Torres would listen to Hitler's speeches in German and recite them in the school hallways. Quote, he went on about Jews, he went on about all minorities, Borkowski told the Associated Press on Wednesday, again quoting, they had to be all put in one place, there was no use for them, that kind of thing, unquote, skipping down. Torres was the high school valedictorian in 1993, but refused to give his speech, Borkowski remembers. Teachers told the Times that Torres refused to speak because officials insisted that they be allowed to approve the text in advance. I wonder what he was planning on saying, given his inclination to recite Hitler's speeches. Skipping down again, it would appear that Torres also was operating with an eye to the future, even in high school. Torres also refused to pose for his senior high school picture, friend Sasheen Timbadia told the newspaper, explaining that he, quote, wanted to keep a low profile in case something happened in the future, unquote. Interesting background for this other American Taliban, someone we haven't been hearing too much about. Now, to the subject material of this broadcast, the major focal point, namely the destabilization of the FBI. This is something that I've spoken about intermittently before, and specifically in For the Record 310, and also in the first broadcast that I did about the September 11th attacks. Actually, for the record, 325 and 326. I spoke about my view that not only elements of U.S. intelligence, but the FBI in particular, was being subverted from within by what was, in effect, a fifth column, at one level allied with the underground Reich, and at another level aligned with elements of the U.S. intelligence that whose main allegiance was not only to the Bush administration's past and present, but also to elements of the petroleum industry, those administrations and the underground Reich being in no way unconnected, though not necessarily coterminous. I can appreciate that this is a complicated concept, perhaps incomprehensible to most listeners. I ask their indulgence, and above all, I ask that they use other broadcasts that I've done about this subject and reference the website for Spitfire as well. I'm going to give you some websites to access later on in the discussion. We're going to take a look now at a book that we've used a number of times in the past in this series on September 11th. It's a book called Dollars for Terror, subtitled The United States and Islam. This book was co-authored, by Richard Labeyrière and translated by Martin Demers. It was originally published in French in 1999, a softcover English language edition published in the year 2000 and copyrighted by Algora Publishing, ALGORA, ISBN number 1-892941-06-6. Visit their website at www.algora.com. What we're going to look at now is discussion of a conflict that occurred between the FBI and elements of CIA. The author here uses CIA in a blanket sense, but I think one could more properly see in this context, given that this book was originally written in French, the Bush/petroleum faction of the CIA. We're going to begin with discussion of a Philippine connection not only to Osama bin Laden through his brother-in-law, something we looked at in For the Record 330. We're also going to take a look at a connection to the first World Trade Center attack, and we're going to take a look in turn at a conference that took place after the embassy bombings in Africa in August of 1998 that we've also looked at in connection with September 11th. More about that in a minute. Turning to Dollars for Terror, the second American connection is more serious, for it directly touches the family relations of Osama bin Laden. One of bin Laden's six wives is Philippine. Since 1991, bin Laden's brother-in-law, Mohammed Jamil Khalif, had overseen the management of the International Islamic Relief Organization, or IIRO, a non-governmental organization that acts as cover for the financing of the Muslim Philippine guerrillas on the island of Mindanao, particularly the terrorist group Abu Sayyaf. Confronted with armed violence on the part of the Islamists in the south of the archipelago, Manila expedited an expulsion order against the brother-in-law in 1994. He had to leave the country, and he managed to enter the United States with a visa that was delivered with help from the CIA. This affair, reminiscent of the visa that was obtained under similar conditions by the Egyptian Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, implicated in the World Trade Center attack, by the way, this book originally authored and published in 1999, was obviously before the World Trade Center was devastated on September 11th. Beginning again, this affair, reminiscent of the visa that was obtained under similar conditions by the Egyptian Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, implicated in the World Trade Center attack, had already caused a crisis between the FBI and the CIA. The CIA had not been able to justify its willingness to support a Filipino suspected of financing terrorist organizations. On August 30, 1998, the Counterterrorism and Security International Journal organized a roundtable bringing together several anti-terrorist experts, including the former federal prosecutor Anders McCarty, Patrick Eddington, private consultant and CIA agent for 9 years, and Edward Bellotto, president of International Association of Counterterrorism and Professional Security, unquote. The discussion makes it clear that the FBI and the CIA had engaged in, quote, a war between the police forces, unquote, since the Gulf War, with the FBI reproaching the intelligence agency for its, quote, too great leniency with regard to its Islamist partners, unquote. To keep the situation from degenerating, the CIA requested that bin Laden's brother-in-law leave the United States in December of 1994. We've seen conflicts between elements of CIA and elements of the FBI in the past. Drug trafficking, the Iran-Contra scandal being one of the points of disagreement and divergence. In this context, one doesn't want to oversimplify the intelligence system in the United States. It's much larger than the CIA, and even the CIA itself has many different factions, some of which are no doubt very loyal and sincere Americans, but other elements of which are not only associated with what I call the underground Reich, but are frankly cynical and more allied with certain profit-making interests or simply bureaucratic inertia under the circumstances, and hence some of the conflicts that exist. I believe that what I call the underground Reich has been deliberately exploiting some of these conflicts and has in fact infiltrated CIA. The late Paul Manning, whose work I've used many times, was of the opinion that the Bormann organization, the underground Reich, had infiltrated the CIA, and that the CIA did not know this, and I think his insights are worth bearing in mind in this context. Now, in the context also of the embassy attacks in August of 1998, which you just heard described, and some of the conflicts that occurred between elements of CIA and elements of FBI over the allegiance between elements of CIA and some of the Islamists, such as Osama bin Laden, we're going to review an article that we looked at in, for the record, 338, and if people will think that my concept of the destabilization of the FBI is so much hot air, well, listen to the following. This is excerpted from, for the record, program number 338, recorded on December 2nd of the year 2001. As I stated in a number of broadcasts dealing with September 11th, I believe that the operational milieu that was involved with the attacks on the United States in fact involve elements that have worked, ostensibly at least, with and for the United States, but that in fact doubled on the United States. A very important and thought-provoking article on just such a U.S. intelligence operative who was involved with Al-Qaeda and, in point of fact, doubling on the United States, was carried in the Wall Street Journal of Monday, November 26th of the year 2001. This is an article by Peter Waldman, Jerry F. Seib, Jerry Markin, and Christopher Cooper, again from the Wall Street Journal of Monday, 11-26, 2001. It's headlined, "The Infiltrator, Ali Mohammed Served in the U.S. Army and Bin Laden's Circle." Subtitled, "Lapses in Handling Sergeant Mirror Larger Failings in FBI's Terror Policy." The first clue, the article reads in part as follows. The first clue came back in 1989 in a field out. The first clue came back in 1989 in a field outside New York City. There, within view of a secret Federal Bureau of Investigation surveillance camera, stood five Arab men taking target practice at a rifle range. At the time, the FBI wrote them off as harmless zealots, fired up to help the Mujahideen fighting the Soviet puppet government in Afghanistan. What the FBI didn't know was that the young Arabs had a special coach, a U.S. Army sergeant from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, named Ali Mohammed, who had been giving them paramilitary training in a nearby New Jersey apartment. And one other thing the agents didn't know until much later, Mr. Mohammed was a longtime member of a radical Islamic militant group banned in Egypt for assassinating President Anwar Sadat. In retrospect, it is now clear that the FBI had stumbled onto a deadly serious terrorist organization on U.S. soil, one that would eventually be absorbed by Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network. All five of the target shooters were later convicted on conspiracy charges related to the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and its aftermath. And the mysterious Mr. Mohammed would appear over and over again, Zelig-like, as Al-Qaeda grew into a genuine threat to American national security. The Sergeant Saga, like the evolution of the broader terrorist threat to America, is the story of intermittent successes, missed clues, and bungled opportunities. The FBI used Mr. Mohammed as an informant at times, extracting from him its first known comprehensive briefing on Al-Qaeda all the way back in 1993. And again, I believe that the September 11th attacks is not an event to be oversimplified. There are elements of U.S. intelligence that were genuinely working against Al-Qaeda, but as the late John O'Neill, who was in charge of the FBI's investigation into Al-Qaeda, concluded before he was killed in those attacks, in fact, the investigation was being frustrated by American corporate ties to Saudi Arabia and oil, and that, in fact, Saudi Arabia was deeply involved in bankrolling Islamic fundamentalism. And I believe that behind that, in turn, and cooperating with that, is what I call the Underground Reich. More about that later. Skipping down in the article, in 1986, after talking about Mr. Muhammad's background with the Egyptian Army Special Forces, in 1986, Mr. Muhammad parlayed his old U.S. Army ties into a spot as an Army supply sergeant and occasional lecturer on Mideast culture at the U.S. Army's Special Warfare School in Fort Bragg, a place where he'd studied earlier as an Egyptian officer. His role there came at a time when the U.S. military was eager to learn more about the Islamic, and moving to an inside page, eager to, beginning again, his role there came at a time when the U.S. military was eager to learn more about the Islamic world. Little is publicly known about his stint there, which lasted until 1989. An Army spokesman declined to comment, and people who knew him there weren't given permission to speak. His new friends back home in California took for granted that Mr. Muhammad was helping the Central Intelligence Agency in its proxy war against the Soviets in Afghanistan. At the time, the anti-Soviet jihad was a worldwide cause among Muslims. Quote, "Everyone in the community knew he was working as a liaison between the CIA and the Afghan cause, and everyone was sympathetic," unquote, says Ali Zaki, a San Jose, California obstetrician who was close to Mr. Muhammad and his American wife, a medical technician named Linda Sanchez. The CIA declines to comment. And as I've indicated in many of the broadcasts, I believe that the milieu that was used against the Soviets in Afghanistan, including the Grand Mufti-founded World Muslim Congress, was equally opposed to the United States, and then, in combination with the Underground Reich, doubled on the United States. Skipping down again, talking about FBI surveillance of Mr. Nasser, a member of this Islamic terrorist network in the New York area. Mr. Nasser assassinated the American rabbi Meir Kahane, the founder of the Koch party in Israel, a Zionist extremist party in Israel. Continuing and skipping down, had officials looked more closely, they would have found an early and startling chain of relationships. Mr. Nasser was part of a local group inspired by Sheikh Omar Rahman and was determined to wage jihad against the U.S. The group was closely connected to the Al-Kifa Refugee Center in Brooklyn, an office that originally was set up to help the anti-Soviet Mujahideen, but was turning into an Al-Qaeda front. And they would have found that Mr. Muhammad was part of the group. Instead, Mr. Muhammad was free to begin his odyssey into the heart of Al-Qaeda. In 1991, he told a New York federal court years later, a request came into the Brooklyn Al-Kifa office. Could he travel to Sudan to help Mr. Bin Laden set up his base of operations there? He went. A year later, he was off to Afghanistan to help train Al-Qaeda operatives in intelligence, military, and explosive methods. Then, a new and much more frightening terror strike finally prompted investigators to dive back into Mr. Nasser's boxes of information. At 12:17 p.m. on February 26, 1993, a truck bomb exploded on the B-2 level of the World Trade Center parking garage. New York's tallest buildings had been hit for the first time, and six people died. A handful of men were arrested and ultimately convicted in the bombing. Along the way, investigators discovered that some of the plotters had a relationship with Mr. Nasser, and they went back to look at his personal possessions. There, they finally saw the link to Mr. Muhammad, and they began to see they were dealing with a network of would-be terrorists, all seemingly inspired by Sheikh Omar, not a couple of stray car bombers. And as federal investigators were about to discover, they were terrorists intent on striking again. In May 1993, 3 months after the bombing, Sheikh Omar was speaking with one of his disciples at his Jersey City, New Jersey apartment when the man asked whether it would be acceptable in Islam to bomb the FBI's Manhattan headquarters. Now listen to the following. This from an FBI wiretap transcript. Quote, slow down a little bit, the Sheikh cautioned, whispering for fear the FBI was bugging his apartment, which it was. Quote, the one who killed Kennedy was trained for 3 years, unquote. It was never made clear in later court testimony which assassination the Sheikh was talking about. This, of course, is very thought-provoking indeed. The context is not altogether clear. I would note that the official assassin of Robert F. Kennedy was a Palestinian Arab, Saran Saran. And I would also note that there are evidentiary tributaries connecting the various assassinations that we had in the 60s, both Kennedy's and Martin Luther King. One of the names connected with a drug smuggling and intelligence ring involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King and allegedly the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. One of the names involved with that was a fellow named Fuad Habash, who was the brother of George Habash, one of the founders of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, one of the Palestinian terrorist organizations, connected with the underground Reich and with the fascist Third Position, opposed to both the former Soviet Union and the United States. And again, it's my belief that the executive authority in the assassinations was in fact what I call the underground Reich. Note also that there are evidentiary tributaries connecting the Oklahoma City bombing and the first World Trade Center bombing and the second attacks on the World Trade Center on September 11th, and that in turn those crimes are connected with the AMIA bombing, or at least there are evidentiary tributaries connecting them with the AMIA bombing in Argentina. More about that later. Skipping down again, speaking of the World Trade Center bombers from 1993, the bomber's paramilitary trainer, Mr. Muhammad, was highly educated, having earned two bachelor's degrees and a master's degree at the University of Alexandria in Egypt. Ramzi Youssef, the calculating mastermind of the bombing, was found in Pakistan in a house paid for by the Bin Laden Network. It turned out that he was closely associated with a Saudi Arabian businessman named Mohammed Jamal Khalifa, who happens to be Mr. Bin Laden's brother-in-law. Skipping it down again. The FBI located Mr. Mohammed near San Francisco in 1993, where he volunteered the earliest insider description of al-Qaeda that is publicly known. In his chat with the FBI, court documents in the embassy bombings case show Mr. Muhammad said Mr. Bin Laden was running a group called al-Qaeda, quote, and was building an army, unquote, that might be used to overthrow the government of Saudi Arabia. He also told the Bureau he had trained terrorists at Mr. Bin Laden's military camps in Sudan and Afghanistan. Yet even though that interview occurred after the World Trade Center blast and after Mr. Muhammad's U.S. training manuals had already been found in Mr. Nasser's possession, Mr. Muhammad was let go without further investigation. Skipping down again. Soon enough, Mr. Muhammad skipped off to Africa on what turned out to be a deadly Bin Laden mission. As he later admitted in court documents, Mr. Bin Laden asked him in 1993 to go to Africa to conduct surveillance of American, British, French, and Israeli targets in Nairobi. I took pictures, drew diagrams, and wrote a report, he testified. He took his research to Sudan, where Mr. Bin Laden then had his headquarters. The terrorist leader, quote, looked at the picture of the American embassy and pointed to where a truck could go as a suicide bomber, unquote, Mr. Muhammad said. A plot to blow up American embassies in Africa, which would mark a turn by al-Qaeda to far more sophisticated operations, was well underway. By 1993, al-Qaeda had established a cell of operations in Kenya. Much as the September 11th hijackers moved in and out of the U.S. for a couple of years, the embassy bombers moved in and out in waves, some conducting surveillance of the embassy, others making preliminary targeting decisions, and still others bringing in supplies to prepare for the attack. The same African cell planned the attack on the U.S. embassy in Tanzania. Even as those plots were falling into place, the FBI was continuing to talk to Mr. Muhammad, never apparently getting a full picture. When prosecutors in the Trade Center conspiracy trial wanted to speak with him, agents working through an intermediary tracked him to a safe house in Nairobi. He told authorities that he had taken a job in the scuba diving business, failing to mention his involvement in the surveillance of al-Qaeda targets. 2 years later, at an interview in October of 1997, he gave agents a detailed account of how he trained Mr. Bin Laden's bodyguards and how al-Qaeda operatives in Somalia helped attack U.S. troops in the early 1990s, causing American deaths, according to court papers. He said he had trained people in, quote, war zones, and war zones can be anywhere, unquote. He also told the FBI that one did not need a fatwa or a ruling from an Islamic religious leader to, quote, to go against the U.S., since it was, quote, obvious, unquote, that the U.S. was the enemy, unquote, court papers say. Still, the U.S. investigators didn't get wind of the African embassy plot, despite Mr. Mohammed's role in it. Finally, in nearly simultaneous attacks on August 7, 1998, the terrorists exploded truck bombs at the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Skipping down again, also found were instructions on where to plant bombs to blow up buildings and how to encode messages for secrecy that this at Mr. Mohammed's home in Sacramento. A week later, prosecutors subpoenaed Mr. Mohammed to testify before a federal grand jury investigating Al-Qaeda in New York. Afterward, he was taken into custody. Quote, for 5 years, he was moving back and forth between the U.S. and Afghanistan. It's impossible the CIA thought he was going there, beginning again, quote, for 5 years, he was moving back and forth between the U.S. and Afghanistan. It's impossible the CIA thought he was going there as a tourist, said Egypt's Mr. Nabil Sharif, a former intelligence officer and a university professor. Again, quoting, if the CIA hadn't caught on to him, it should be dissolved and its budget used for something worthwhile, unquote. Again, the possibility of a fifth column is one to be very seriously considered here.
And we're going to move away from, for the record, program number 338. Again, bear in mind the concept of a fifth column. Bear in mind also the concept of just as I spoke of the Galen Organization as a Trojan horse in the long archive show, for the record, 337. So, too, consider the Islamic fundamentalist forces as basically something very similar, sort of a Trojan horse operating within U.S. intelligence, ostensibly not only for anti-communist purposes, but also for purposes of ultimately destroying the United States in conjunction with, to a certain extent, the underground Reich. I've alluded to other broadcasts that I've made over the years. Those are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Their email is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. You can visit their website, Real Audio Equipped website, at www.spitfirelist.com. There will be a detailed annotated description of For the Record program number 349 on the Spitfire website within a few days of the broadcast. There are also links to two websites in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, and in those descriptions to two websites maintained by WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. One of them has programs streaming. That is WFMU.org/Dave Emory, DaveEmory. There was a longer URL with For the Record programs available for download only. Sister station WFMU has virtually the entire For the Record series on Real Audio. The first broadcast of each For the Record program takes place at 9 p.m. Pacific Time on KKUP-FM. Visit their website at www.kkup.com for instructions about how to listen. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 349, The Destabilization of the FBI. This is being recorded on February 25th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.